Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem. My guest today is Emily Collin. Emily is the author of two novels, The Memory Thief, which was a New York Times bestseller, and her new book, The Dream Keeper's Daughter, published earlier this month. Emily, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thanks so much, Charlie. I'm really excited to be here.
So the last time we saw each other was about 4 years ago, and you had lunch at my house with Melanie Benjamin and Erica Roebuck, and my first novel was about 2 months away from being published. And the three of you were full of all sorts of great advice about what the world was going to be like for a new novelist. Tell us a little bit about your path over the past 4 years that led you to The Dreamkeeper's Daughter.
Sure. Well, before I had written The Memory Thief, which was my first book, I was working for a nonprofit organization called Dreams of Wilmington, which was dedicated to serving youth in need through the arts. And it was actually working there that drove me to write The Memory Thief, because I was surrounded by these incredible artists, both children and adults, and realized that I was not creating myself. And so after I wrote The Memory Thief, I ended up going back to work at Dreams, and while working there, tried to write my second novel and realized that I'm just not one of those people who can write a novel in 20 minutes on my lunch break. I tried every morning. I'd try like for 20 minutes before I went to work, and I'd try at lunch. But in the end, I wound up with this tome, basically, that was very long and could have been a doorstop or a sleep aid or a weapon maybe, but certainly not an enjoyable read. And so from that, I realized that I needed to step away and focus on my writing full time if I wanted to complete another book. And so it was that path, really, that led me to write The Dreamkeeper's Daughter. And I stepped away and was able to focus on the novel more deeply and delve into it. And when I did that, it all began to come together. And of course, it was a much longer process with lots of research and a great deal of delving and discovery, but it all led me to completing that book.
So give us what we call the elevator pitch for The Dreamkeeper's Daughter.
Sure. So The Dreamkeeper's Daughter is, first of all, a love story, but it's also a story of adventure. It's a story of rebellion, and it's a story of time travel. And it is set partially in modern day Charleston and partially in 19th century Barbados on the eve of the 1816 rebellion. And it is really, it's two different people's stories, but they're running in parallel. But as they come together, you realize that they're impacting each other in ways that will change both of their lives forever.
Can you read a little excerpt for us?
Sure, I would love to. What I'll do is I'll read you the very beginning of the book. This is a book with a bunch of suspense in it, so it's hard when you have books like that because you can't read from the middle, so you're afraid of giving too much away. So I should say this before I read this very beginning. The image that drove me to write this book that leads to the part that I'm about to read was an image of a woman running through the woods. And I knew that she was running after someone, a man that she loved very much, and that she was calling his name. And he was saying, "Stay where you are." But she ran after him anyway. And then he disappeared. And I knew that no matter how hard she looked in those woods, she could not find him again. And I knew another thing, too, that she was pregnant with his child. As if that wasn't bad enough, I knew a third thing. I knew that this was not the first person she had lost. And I knew that she had also lost her mother several years before without explanation. Her mother had also disappeared, and that this man was the only thing that had kept her going. And so to lose both of them like that really was life-changing for her. And she has no idea what's happened to them and is determined to build her life regardless. So this is the very beginning of the book, and this gives you the context for why it matters so much. I am on my knees, the sun beating on my back, and dirt from long dead bones sifting through my glove fingers when my cell phone rings. Focused as I am on the dig, the phone's shrill summons startles me. I jolt upright and lose my balance, falling on my butt and sending a cloud of dirt into the air. Behind me, I hear Jake, one of my graduate students, let out what can be only described as a guffaw. I swivel to glare at him, and he smothers it into a cough, looking abashed. Color creeps up his cheeks, already reddened from the sun and wind. I assume the phone call will be from my supervisor back at the College of Charleston, or from my dad, who keeps Finn, my 7-year-old daughter, when I do field work. Squinting to make out the number, I try to suppress the instinctive, icy panic I feel whenever the phone rings. It's the school. Finn is gone. She was on the playground at recess, and now they can't find her anywhere. It's like she vanished into thin air. It's not useful to react this way, I admonish myself. It's not productive, but I can't help it. For all my years of mixed martial arts training and a black belt in judo, I still don't feel like the world is a safe place, a place where people stay. Then I see who's calling me, and I forget Jake, forget Finn, forget everything but the 3 innocuous little letters that have appeared on my screen. Max. The phone rings again, but my hands are shaking so badly that it takes what feels like forever to get my gloves off, and then 2 tries before I can answer the call. My heart beats in triple time as I press the phone to my ear. Hello, I say, and then when there's no response, Max, is that you? There is silence on the other end of the line, and then, as if coming from the end of a long, long tunnel, laced with static, a voice I thought I'd never hear again, Isabel. All he says is my name, but it's Max, there's no doubt in my mind. In the 6 years we knew each other, I heard Max say my name innumerable times, in 1,000 different ways, hollering at me from the woods that linked our houses, eager for me to come outside, trying to get my attention as we lay next to each other in the treehouse he'd built, paging through old National Geographics. In wonder, the first time he kissed me, his fingers light on my face. And later, when we made Finn, as if those 3 syllables were a sacrament, a holy word that held more meaning than, I love you. I would know Max's voice anywhere. The thing is, I haven't heard it since before Finn was born. My fingers are suddenly nerveless, and the pick I'm holding thumps into the dirt. Oh my God, Max, I say, where are you? Silence on the other end of the line, and then he says my name again, his voice limp with desperation. Isabel, he says, and then there is static. In frustration, I press the phone harder against my ear, trying to make out the words, but I can't understand a damn thing. Then his voice comes clear again. Keep her safe. Max, I can hardly hear you. Keep who safe? Tell me where you are, I say. But it's too late. I'm talking to an empty line. I try to call back, but all I hear is the message I've gotten for the past 7 years. The number you've dialed has been disconnected or is no longer in service. I call over and over, but the result is the same. Gradually, I become aware that I'm still kneeling in the dirt, tears spilling down my face in the middle of an archaeological dig I'm supposed to be overseeing. One by one, the blurry faces of my grad students swim into view. Jake is staring at me, puzzled and alarmed. Dizzy, half blind, I get to my feet. Excuse me, I mumble. And then I do something I've never done before, not in 5 years of graduate school and 2 years of teaching. I walk right off the dig.
One of the things I love about that opening is the way it moves around in time, and your novel moves around in time, as you said. That's something you and I have in common. We've both written novels that move back and forth into different time periods. You're moving back and forth between modern day South Carolina and 19th century Barbados. Can you talk a little bit about how you handled those time shifts?
Absolutely. You know, for me, and you'd know more about this than I, having so much more experience writing historical pieces, this was the first novel I'd ever written that had a historical basis. So there was a lot involved for me in really trying to make sure that I got the history right, or as right as you can. You never really know with history. But so because of that, because of my in-depth research and my pursuit of accuracy, there was a real relief in feeling like I had this supernatural piece to play with, that I could invent whatever mechanism I wanted to move my character back and forth in time, that I had that freedom. And so for me, that piece of it was a lot of fun. And the other thing I think that helped me with it too is I'm not typically a plotter. I think we have talked about this before when I was at Bookmarks recently. I don't usually plot my novels out in advance. It's more like I know the beginning and I know where I want it to go, but in the middle, the fun for me is discovering the route to my destination. But when you're relying on historical information and historical sources, you can't do that as much. So I knew that I was going to have to take a bit of a different approach for the parts that were back in time. And so what I did was I have a habit of just writing scenes as they occur to me. I don't write in order. I write those scenes that I'm most excited about. And then I kind of string them together. And so I did that with the pieces that took place in modern day Charleston and modern day Barbados. But for the pieces that took place in 19th century Barbados, I knew I was going to have to write them from point A to point Z. And so I wrote all the other pieces first in my normal catch-as-catch-can fun fashion. And then I had an outline, which is so anathema to normally how I work, but I knew I was going to need it. And I blocked the scenes, and then I went ahead and wrote them. And it was one of the most challenging things I'd ever done as a writer. But in the end, I feel like I grew so much from it.
So your Barbados history is based around an event that happened in 1816, a slave rebellion. Tell us a little bit first about how you came across the history of that event and about the event itself.
Absolutely. You know, I feel like with everything that's going on in the country right now, it's particularly relevant to have written a book that focuses on a man's struggle to deal with his role in the oppression of a group of people in his ancestral past. So I didn't do that on purpose, timing-wise. But, you know, the way this came to be was, you know, I had that image, like I told you, of the man running away in the woods. And I had the emotional content and the emotional feeling that went with it. And I knew that this woman who was left behind had lost her mom. And I presented all of this to my editor. And my editor was like, this is so great. This is so exciting. Where did the man go? I had no idea, literally no idea. And as I think I mentioned again when we talked at Bookmarks, I said, you know, I came up with theories. Each one was more absurd than the next. It was alien kidnappings and it was political conspiracies and just none of them worked. And even if they did work, none of them were who I was as a writer. And so I really thought about this and I thought, okay, so I know that I like to be able to travel and research the locations that I'm writing about. So I knew that at least one location that the book was set in was going to have to be driving distance so I could usually get there. And I'd already written a book set in Wilmington, North Carolina, where I live. So I decided to set this one in Charleston. And when I discovered that I was going to have to deal with this disappearance piece, then I started thinking, okay, what if instead of alien invasions and political conspiracies, there was a time travel piece? But I really did not want that to be hackneyed or overused or cliched. And so I thought, if I do this, it can't be heavy-handed or just a device. It has to be a character going back in time to a point in time that is really significant to his entire life, a point in time that maybe has a conflict that shapes everything that he and his family becomes. And I thought, well, this is the South. What about slavery? And so I began looking into the Charleston's history, and I very quickly found the connection between Charleston and Barbados. So then I went and I researched Barbados some more, and I had been familiar with the Haitian rebellion, of course, but I had not realized that there was this pivotal rebellion that took place in Barbados in 1816. So I discovered that and felt ignorant that I hadn't known and started to learn about it. And the more I learned about it, the more fascinated I became by the nature of it, by its role in history, by some of the figures themselves who were involved in the rebellion, including this amazing female slave rebel named Nanny Grigg, who's in the book. And so I decided that this was the route that I was going to take. And I ended up traveling to Barbados during the course of researching the book. And I spent 10 days just doing some fun Barbados stuff, sure. But a lot of it was spent in museums, in libraries, in the Bridgetown Public Library, going through microfilm of the 1816 Barbados newspapers to really get a sense of what was going on, touring abbeys, driving all around the island, and just immersing myself as much as I could in primary and secondary sources to do my best to tell the story.
And when you were in Barbados, did you have contact with people there? What were the feelings of the locals about what you were working on?
Well, you know, I went to Barbados having gotten a sense of what the resources might be available for me, but not knowing anybody. And I felt, and probably rightfully so, is it was the truth that no matter what I thought I knew, there was going to be so much more that I did not know. And that being there, more and more questions would arise and I'd have to figure out who to ask as they did arise. And I was very, very lucky to be staying near the Barbados Museum and Historical Society that has a fantastic library and archives. And I went there and, you know, it's open to the public. You've got to leave your bag at the front. And of course you can't take liquids in and you can only write with a pencil, all the good stuff, you know. And there was a wonderful librarian there who is still there. Her name is Harriet Pierce. And I explained to her what I wanted to do, and I felt kind of strange and awkward explaining it and very ignorant. And I told her what I did know, and I told her what I needed to learn. And I just basically asked for her help. And she was wonderful and amazing. And she brought out source after source. And the more questions I asked, the more helpful she was. And so she was really pivotal and really wonderful in that way. And in fact, I just got in touch with her, having credited her in the acknowledgments of the book for her help to let her know the book was in the world and asking if she would like a copy. And she said she would. So, you know, after we wrap up this podcast, that's actually what I'm doing, is going to mail a copy to Harriet Pierce. But, you know, I also just asked questions of people who lived in Barbados, whose family had lived there for generations. Asking if they ever thought about the rebellion, how it had impacted their lives, how would they feel about a book like this being in the world? Would they feel like it was appropriation? So I asked those questions. And then I also went, like I said, to the public library and talked to librarians there and asked them for everything that I could possibly find. And then I came back and I read book after book after book and journal article after journal article and did everything that I could to put together the most rounded, while also detail-oriented depiction in my head of the rebellion so that I could stay as true to that as possible while also incorporating my fictional piece.
So you're a white female writer writing about slavery in the 19th century. Did you have concerns about cultural appropriation? And if so, how did you handle that?
I had tremendous, tremendous concerns about that. I was very worried about it. And I spoke with a couple of my friends of color and said, you know, am I doing the wrong thing? Is this not okay? Should I not do this? And they were reassuring towards me, so that made me feel a little bit better. But I also felt, you know, it's kind of how I felt in a different sense when I was writing The Memory Thief. You know, I hate heights, and I was called to tell this story about a mountain climber. And I thought, really? Can I not be called to tell a story about a cook? I like to eat, and I'm not afraid of food, you know? And, you know, so that was on a very minor level, but yet it was the story that I was compelled to tell. And so this was on a very major level. I felt compelled to tell this story. And even more so, I felt compelled to give voice on a larger scale to these incredibly brave human beings who have so little to show in the world historical stage for most of us for their bravery. You know, they fought this battle. They knew they were probably going to lose. It was a failed rebellion. They didn't have the weapons that the white armies felt, but their freedom was so significant, so important to them that they fought anyhow. And I had so much incredible respect for that. And I wanted to be able to tell that story in a way that didn't just make it Max's story, you know, my white male character, made it their story. So that was very, very important to me. And one reason that I felt that the accuracy of it was significant. And also, again, that I wasn't telling the story simply as a device for Max to go back in time. And isn't it convenient that I have this rebellion to use? I wanted him to feel a tremendous moral conflict about it, about what was the right thing to do. And so he is a privileged white Southern man in his 20s who has grown up knowing that his blood is tainted by the, you know, the institution of slavery. And he's never felt okay with profiting from that. All of his family are lawyers. He's decided to be a gardener. He does a senior thesis on the slave rebellion. He feels, and rightfully so, that his blood is stained and there's nothing, nothing that he can ever do to make it right. And so when he gets transported back in time on the eve of the slave rebellion, he feels a terrible conflict. On the one hand, does he go ahead and let the slaves know that their rebellion is doomed to failure? Well, he could do that. And in so doing, he'll save their lives, these brave people who don't deserve to die. But then on the other hand, what right does he possibly have to tell these people who have been historically so terribly oppressed that they don't have the right to stand up and fight? And then he deals with the knowledge of the paradoxes of what will befall him if he stops this rebellion. So part of the way that I dealt with this was through my character's struggle, but I was very, very concerned with many pieces of it. I was concerned with the dialect piece of it and that be represented fairly. I was concerned about the idea that perhaps I would be seen as interloping into a story that was not mine to tell. But in the end, I felt that since I was called to tell this story, that the best thing I could do was do the most accurate and comprehensive research that I could, do my very best and utmost, try to be conscious of the fact that I was not of this culture and writing about it, acknowledge my ignorance and ask for help, and then do my best and let the chips fall where they may.
So we've been having a lot of conversations in the, what I guess we would call the post-Charlottesville South over the last couple of weeks about what constitutes our history and what constitutes remembering or not remembering our history. Is it statues or is it something else? And I think that historical novels can be an important part of that narrative. Do you see your novel as preserving a piece of history in a way that a statue or a painting maybe can't do?
You know, it's interesting that you should say it, because when I wrote the novel, I was only thinking in terms of the people whose story it was telling, historically speaking, and then, of course, my pretend characters. But then it came time to write the dedication, not the acknowledgments where you thank everybody, but, you know, who was this book for? Who did you write this book for? And I went back and forth, you know, as one does. Is it for my mom? Is it for so-and-so? Is it for so-and-so? And I was stuck. I knew that nothing I was thinking of was the right thing. And then I came to it. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to read the dedication, because I think it answers a little bit of this question. And then I'll answer your question directly. So this is who this book is for. This book is for the justice warriors, for those who fight for what they believe in, to give voice to the voiceless and agency to the oppressed, though the battle is long and the rewards may be long in coming. This book is for the voiceless and the oppressed. Your thoughts and words matter, though it may often seem otherwise. You matter. Don't let anyone convince you otherwise. You hold in your hearts the power to change the world. This book is for the heroes whose lives are dedicated to a cause greater than themselves, who work long hours for little money and sometimes for no money at all. There is always more work to be done. There is never enough time. Because you would never sing your own praises, I'll sing them for you. The world is a better place with you in it. And finally, this book is for the artists, the writers and musicians, the painters and playwrights. Now more than ever, we need you. Accept nothing. Make us uncomfortable. Keep us curious. Show us the truth. See us home. So that's the dedication that I wrote. And in light of what's going on in Charlottesville and elsewhere, I've been really thinking about it. You know, so I am Jewish. My family is from Eastern Europe. They suffered in the pogroms. We lost people in the Holocaust. And when I see hate mongers chanting these horrible, horrible racist slogans and epithets and blood and soil and all of that, I also see them with swastikas. And so as a Jewish person, I can quote unquote pass in the way that a person of color cannot necessarily pass. So I do have that get out of jail, quote unquote, free card of my white skin. But, you know, dig a little bit beneath that to what happened in the Holocaust, and I don't have that safety whatsoever. It's an illusion, right? And so I feel like it is our duty, all of us who believe that what is happening is not right, is not okay, is dangerous, is terrifying, cannot be allowed to continue, all of the things that there aren't even words for it, really, to say, except for knowing in your deepest, deepest heart that it's wrong and you have to speak out and you have to speak up and you have to defend those who are defenseless if you have that privilege. I believe that art can do that in a way that many other things cannot. And, you know, during my time working at Dreams, there have been multiple occasions where I have seen a mom from public housing standing up and dancing and clapping next to a woman from the country club standing up and dancing and clapping. And in that moment, that divide, that bridge doesn't exist between them, despite the tremendous variance in their life experiences. They've got something in common. There's a bridge. It's there. And so I believe that artists and art have always had that ability to take those risks, to be daring, to build those bridges. And as creators, it's our responsibility to do that. If we're not doing that, then we're failing as artists.
I think you're absolutely right that a novel, perhaps more than any other art form, allows us to submerge ourselves in an experience that is not ours, that is radically different from what we know, and that opens our eyes to a different way of living. I want to move on to a wonderful quote on the back of the book by Samantha Soto. She says, "This book thins out the line between present and past, dream and reality." So what do you accomplish by thinning out that line narratively?
Well, I think she probably chose that verbiage because the device that I use for time travel is called a thin place. And in fact, the original title of the book, rather than The Dreamkeeper's Daughter, was The Thin Place. And we changed it for a variety of reasons. But, you know, the idea of thinning out that line initially came from this concept, which is a Scottish myth, that there's a place where the veil between the living and the dead is thin. And sometimes that's thought to happen on All Hallows' Eve. Sometimes it's thought to be connected with a particular geographical location. But the idea being that we are not as far apart as we think that we are. And, you know, I meant that in a supernatural way by creating the thin place. But I also think that the events that are going on right now, not to circle back to that, but really does show us that we're you know, those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it, to bastardize that quote. I feel like the past is always with us. It's always here. Even when we don't see it, it informs who we are and our choices and how we see the world, both in terms of our personal past and then the larger societal past in which we're embedded. And so for me, the idea of thinning out narratively that connection between present and past, where all things are being experienced at the same time, and where you never know what has led to something taking place, what's changed it. If only this one thing had been different, what would have happened? How fragile our construction of our identities and ourselves and our present, you know, all of those things are. So that for me was the tremendous excitement of being able to thin out that line between present and past, blur it together, but do so in a way that was suspenseful, that drove the story forward, and that really built those kinds of questions in the reader's mind of what really did happen and what's going to happen next.
I think I do that a lot in my work too, trying to make connections between the past and the present. And I write a lot about old books. And so often the connection comes through not just a piece of writing, but an actual physical book that someone holds in their hands. But I think you can do it with almost anything. There's so many different ways we can connect to the past and understand how it is a part of us.
I agree completely. And I, you know, and I think that depending on what you write and what you read, but no matter who you are in the world, having that understanding can be transformative.
So The Dreamkeeper's Daughter was published, about 2 weeks ago. Is that right?
Actually a little bit longer. I can't believe it. It was July 25th. So it's exactly a month ago.
It's been going quickly. Okay. And when I remember so clearly that lunch that I had with you and Erica and Melanie, and I was this, you know, about to be published novelist, and all three of you had successful books. And it was like suddenly having three older sisters that were full of great advice. I was getting ready to go on my first book tour. And a lot of the things that I still do when I'm out on tour are things that we talked about at that luncheon. So what advice would you have, having been out plugging this book for the last month, for first timers who are just entering that world of what it is like to not write a book, but have to promote a book?
Well, one thing I would say for sure is that the process of promoting your book cannot begin the day you've got a book in your hand or the day that you've got an arc in your hand. So the literary world is small. The literary world, wherever you live, whether it's the North or the South or the Northwest, has its own rhythms and its own contacts. And so, you know, what I think is so important for someone to do when they know that they've got a book in the works, when they're writing a book, even before they have an agent, is to find that community. Get to know your local and your regional independent booksellers when you travel. Stop in and say hello to them and build relationships with them. Follow them on social media. Follow the people who read what or who write what you like to read, rather, on social media. Keep up with trends in the market. Really involve yourself with that community and plug yourself into that community. Find out beforehand if there are author luncheons in your area. Get to know what that landscape looks like so that when your book comes out, you're not just approaching people and asking them for favors. You have a relationship with them. And I think that, you know, like everything else, this is about knowledge, book promotion, and it also is about relationships. And it's about making sure that you have the ability to share your content with the people who are most interested in receiving it. So if you can plug into that community and get to know people beforehand and have genuine connections, that will be reflected and people will be excited to help you.
I think that's absolutely true. For me, that's happened through bookmarks, but I could certainly recommend people find a literary nonprofit in their area. When I filled out that first author information form, and you know, you get to that question about what authors do you know who might write blurbs for the back of your dust jacket? I had nobody. And after 4 or 5 years of working very closely with Bookmarks, which puts on a book festival and brings authors like yourself to town, I have many, many friends who are authors, from first-time novelists to international bestsellers. And it was all part of just being active in that community.
I agree completely. And I think, you know, when you're just starting out, it's interesting. Are you familiar with the contest called Pitch Wars?
I've heard of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So for those who aren't familiar with it, Pitch Wars is a wonderful, wonderful online contest. And it is, I guess it was founded in 2012. Brenda Drake is the person who started it. And the idea is that experienced editors and experienced authors mentor authors who are ready to take that plunge to polish their manuscript, to find an agent and set their feet on that road to publication. And so it's a really fascinating process where there's a huge online community, both for the prospective mentees and the mentors. And there's opportunities for the prospective mentees to engage with the mentors and ask all kinds of questions. Then all of us mentors, and I'm mentoring this year for the first time, come up with wish lists of what we want in terms of genres, what type of manuscripts we'd like to mentor, what our approach is. And then there was a period of time where the mentees get to submit their manuscripts to us, and a period of time where we review, ask for partials and fulls in the way that an agent might, based on what we see. And then we go ahead and we choose one or sometimes more, depending on situations, but usually one individual to mentor for 2 months. And so, you know, as a part of that, I've really been moved to see this incredible power of community. And even the mentees who have not necessarily been chosen officially are all saying how much they've learned from this experience, how, you know, they're gaining critique partners, how they've been to the different experienced mentors' blogs, and they're learning about writing. And so it can be so hard in this business. You see this person won an award and this person's on that list, and oh my gosh, you know, you work so hard and why have they been awarded this? And so I think the other thing that's so important to do is to maintain this tremendous attitude of generosity and have a philosophy of abundance rather than scarcity, even though it's so hard. And so go out and celebrate the other authors in your area, even though you're green with envy and you think, why isn't it me? You know, give back and know that if you keep putting that energy out there, one day it will be you in one way or another. And so I think, you know, having been a part of this and continuing to be a part of this tremendous Pitch Wars community has shown me how this community can form across all countries around the globe, just through the tremendous generosity of the mentors and the determination of the writers. So, you know, that connection piece, finding your tribe, finding people who get you, and educating yourself about the process and the market and just what it means to be out here in this business, which is so hard, and finding support and being kind to yourself is also important.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the things I find wonderful about that writer's community To me, it's like a community of runners. I'm a long distance runner. And when you go and you show up at a marathon or a half marathon, you're not competing against all those thousands of other people. They're all there supporting one another. And it's the same in writing, even though technically, yes, we are competing with one another. I've found that there's just tremendous support among writers for those who are at the very top and those who are just beginning. And it's wonderful to be a part of. Let me ask you a quick question about editing, because this sort of goes to what you were talking about with the pitch wars. Were there major changes that your editor asked you to make in this book? And what's your attitude towards rewriting to an editor's requests?
Oh my gosh, yes. There were such major changes. So I changed editors in the middle of this manuscript. My previous editor that I had for The Memory Thief was also my editor at the beginning of this, of The Dreamkeeper's Daughter, and she then retired. Luckily for me, her assistant, who had been working on this book all along, and I loved the assistant, who is my current editor, Alana Jolie, and had a wonderful relationship with her. And so when Linda Marrow, my first editor, retired, The Dreamkeeper's Daughter went into Alana's very capable hands. There, you know, everyone knows as a writer what their strengths and what their weaknesses are, you know, or if you don't know, you find it out pretty quickly. And so I know that, you know, I know what my strengths are, and I know that one of my weaknesses can be to overexplain or to want everybody to understand every piece of it. And sometimes that leads to manuscripts being longer than they should be. And so when I wrote this book, I originally envisioned it actually as a trilogy. And my agent said, oh my gosh, you've lost your mind. This has to be one book, you know? And I was like, but look, it's clearly a book in three acts. And she was like, that's really nice. Could it be a shorter book in three acts? And I was like, okay. So, you know, I finished the book and I want to say that this book, which is now 460 pages in print on my computer, and I don't remember how many words, but it was 690 pages, so almost a 700-page book. My poor, poor editor, you know, and so she's the nicest person in the world. She got this, and she was like, I believe we're going to have to cut this a little bit. And I was like, okay, but the thing is, I have no idea what to cut. So I said to her, I trust you. If you tell me what to cut and you tell me that you can understand the story without these scenes, I trust you because I can't see that anymore. I've been staring at this too long. So, you know, it went from 690 pages to 460 pages. And there were very few times when I dug in my heels and said, okay, no, this has got to stay. And if I did, I always gave her a reason. This has got to stay because I think it's so important to understanding this character. This has got to stay, but because without it, this decision makes no sense. But I truly believe that those cuts made the book entirely better. And by the time I hand a manuscript in, I want that feedback. I want that help. They're my editor for a reason. So I feel like you can't be that way in this business, you know. Otherwise, you should just write for yourself in a journal or something, which is, has its merits as well. But if you're going to put it out there, you got to trust your editor or find another one. And I think that she made it so much of a better book.
I think that's so true that you have to allow another pair of eyes to look at what you can't see. You're just too close to it yourself. And I find I feel lucky that I get, you know, a very talented agent and a very talented editor who are going to look at my work and say, look, here's a way we can all three together make it even better than it is. So we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same set of 10 questions. They're very short answer questions. There is no scoring. This is not a pop quiz or anything. But I'm going to just run through these questions for you, and hopefully they will help us to learn a little bit more about writing and a little bit more about Emily Collin. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. What word do you love to work into your writing?
As a literal word that's present in it or a feeling behind it?
Oh, either one.
Tension.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Bosom.
Where's your favorite place to write?
In a coffee shop with a mocha in one hand and typing on the keyboard with the other.
Where could you never write?
I do not think that there is any place that I could never write. I have written on the other side of a thin wall with a bunch of kids engaging in African drumming and singing on the other side of it. So you name it, I can write there.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I would say probably the fact that when you are writing a particular character, if they think in run-on sentences and that's the way that their brain works, something like that those rules can be broken if they are a part of your particular character's form of communication.
What was the first book you remember reading?
You know what? A Wizard of Oz.
What are you reading right now?
Patrick Rothfuss's The Name of the Wind.
What book would you like to have written?
I think Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time.
What kind of book would you like to write but probably never will?
I'd like to write a really amazing middle grade novel, but I think there's too much sex in my books to make that happen.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
That they couldn't put my book down, but not because it moved them intellectually, because it moved them emotionally and helped and change them in some way.
This is not part of the 10 questions. You've done very well. But one more question. What are you working on now?
Two things. So despite the supposed sexiness of my adult work, I've managed to tone that down a little bit to write a YA novel, young adult novel. And so that's done, and it's in the phase of me kind of going into the final round of revisions before sending it out on submission. So there's that. And the other thing that I'm working on is my next book for adults, which is a very interesting combination of love, betrayal, a wolf behavioral specialist, and ancient Icelandic legends.
Great. This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today has been Emily Collin, whose new novel, The Dreamkeeper's Daughter, is available wherever books are sold. And of course, you can always get signed copies at Bookmarks. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been my very great pleasure.
You've been listening to Inside the Writer's Studio. To find out more about our sponsor, Bookmarks, and all its programs and events, visit bookmarksnc.org. Join me next time on Inside the Writer's Studio with New York Times bestselling novelist Robin Sloan, author of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. Robin will be appearing at this year's Bookmarks Festival of Books and Authors, and will be discussing his highly anticipated second novel, Sourdough. I'm sure it will be a great conversation. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.